couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Spies in Disguise, Little Women, 1917, and Just Mercy. I'll also be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the Universal Horror Collection, Volume 3. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's not a whole lot of burgeoning news right now because, you know, kind of we're at the end of the year and L.A. does kind of take off during Christmas and New Year's. But the news that's been coming out has been all related to sort of like the politics around recent releases, either Star Wars or Little Women. And I want to hit some of the Star Wars stuff first. The one that I've been seeing, and I knew I was going to see this showing up at some point in social media, there's finally this push to get to release the Tico cut. And I don't know if they're meaning this to be a real thing. And I think it's spinning off of there's the release the Snyder cut of Justice League, basically saying release what Zack Snyder would have done with Justice League. Now people are saying release the Tico cut, which I don't know if they're actually asking for a recut of Rise of Skywalker with more Rose Tico in it. I don't think that stuff was actually shot. I think she was just sidelined as a character. And that happened. She was completely Jar Jar Binks'd in the movie. And with good reason, because Rose Tico was a crappy character. And I've seen people who loved Rian Johnson's work on The Last Jedi saying, oh, I've seen people use terms, oh, she was the anchor. She was the heart and soul. BS she was. Nobody liked her who had any sort of Star Wars sense. Part of what happened, and I said this with last week, is it felt like The Force Awakens was a movie that was made by somebody who actually loved Star Wars. And then The Last Jedi was made by somebody who wanted to mansplain to everybody what they should like in a movie. And that's the problem. Rian Johnson wasn't going with a Star Wars story. He was trying to break down and do the opposite of a Star Wars story. And so J.J. Abrams had to spend so much time rewriting that ship and going towards a discernible end to it. Now, Rose Tico was sidelined as a character because she was a lousy character. You could make a whole movie series of her going into different forms of pop culture and telling people not to do things. You can have her go into the end of and tell Tony Stark to not snap his fingers. You know, you could have her go into the end of the original Star Wars and tell Han Solo to not go in there and shoot Darth Vader's TIE fighter out of the sky. She was a bad character, and it's good that she's been removed. I don't have nothing against the actress, but the character of Rose Tico was properly placed in Rise of Skywalker because she was so bad. Now, the other thing that's happening with Star Wars is people are complaining because apparently there's a lot of stuff in the movie that's passingly mentioned. And like the biggest example people use is the Knights of Ren, which were basically the personal muscle of Kylo Ren. And everyone's like, well, who are they? Well, we don't know who they are. And I'm like, well, it was said in the last movie that he left Luke and he took some of the other Jedi recruits with him. I just assumed that's who they were, and they kind of just became his henchmen, but were sort of elite henchmen. That was just an assumption I made. And apparently there's a book you can buy that goes through and it fills a lot of these gaps. And people are all raging now on, you shouldn't have to buy a book to understand this movie. And I'm like, is it really that big of a deal? Because if you go back to what Star Wars was originally done as, back when they released Star Wars in 1977, he didn't even call it Episode 4, but what Lucas wanted from that in the very original release, he wanted to get the feeling of what it was like coming into the middle of a story. That's why he did it as Episode 4. He's like, I wanted to just kind of drop somebody in, kind of like when you go see a movie serial that played in. If you don't know, I figure I'll take a minute to explain to people, because there might be people who are younger, don't know that they used to do this. You'd go to the movies and they'd show not just trailers, but they'd show short films. They'd have newsreels because they didn't have television news back then. That's how you got your news of the day. So you get newsreels. You'd have cartoons, and they'd sometimes have a serial. You'd have a whole hour, hour and a half of pre-show content that would play before the feature. And what they do is they'd have these, there were serials or chapter plays where they'd have like 10 to 15 episodes, each one being 10 to 20 minutes. And they're a little adventure and they'd each end with a cliffhanger. Depending on what theater you went to, very rarely would you go see each one in a row. So you might go one weekend in a theater and see the fourth episode of a Buck Rogers one. And then you go to another theater the next weekend and you see the 13th episode of a Flash Gordon serial. So you would see them out of order and incomplete. And that's what Lucas was going for with Star Wars. So in this new movie, there's a lot of stuff that's dropped in there that there's so much information thrown at you that you just know it just enriches the background. But it really doesn't make a huge impact on the story. You just know that these people were there with Kylo Ren as his personal muscle. And that actually plays out in the original Star Wars. The scene in the original Star Wars where Luke gets his lightsaber from Ben Kenobi, Ben Kenobi mentions, oh, I fought in the Clone Wars with your father. That's the only time the Clone Wars is mentioned in that episode. And I think it's mentioned a couple other times in Empire and Jedi, but not a whole lot of background is given. And I remember being a kid thinking, these Clone Wars, that sounds really cool. I think that was what J.J. Abrams' idea was. We put all this stuff in there, you throw so much into it that you do feel like you're coming into the middle of it, which is what Star Wars originally was. That's what gave it such an epic feel, that it was bigger than the internal narrative that it was facing. So, you know, these people are complaining because they don't know what this character is or what the background of this is or who's that guy. That's kind of part of the deal. And yeah, you always could buy that extended universe stuff, and you can buy these books that talked about the characters. Same thing with the Tusken Raiders in the first Star Wars. You didn't know who the Tusken Raiders are. The Sand People, I don't know who they are. The Bantha Milk, they're drinking blue milk. They didn't explain that that was Bantha Milk. They just had blue milk on their table. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is The Gentlemen, which opens on January 24th. It's Guy Ritchie's new film.
There once was a young and foolish dragon who came to ask a wise and cunning lion about acquiring his territory. Now the lion, he wasn't interested, so he told the little dragon to fight. The dragon, he persisted.
Oh, goody.
He started a war. So the lion took the little dragon for a walk and put five bullets in his little dragon head.
He's warming up now, isn't it?
There's a message in there.
This looks like it might be kind of fun. It's a little higher end for Guy Ritchie. You know, he started out when he was doing stuff like Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Those are very gritty street stories in London. This looks a little bit snazzier. It's a little slick, a little bit more finesse to it, a little bit more of almost a James Bond feel, but a rugby playing James Bond than somebody who plays polo. So this looks like it might be fun. I'm curious. Guy Ritchie blows so hot and cold, so who knows? The next one is Top Gun Maverick, opens on June 26th.
Your reputation precedes you.
I have to admit, I wasn't expecting an invitation back.
They're called orders, Maverick.
Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking. Today's exercise is dogfighting.
Two versus one? Oh, you've got to be kidding.
What the hell? I will say this. It looks like a Top Gun movie. It looks like it's trying to recapture everything that was Top Gun back in the 80s. From driving the motorcycle with her hugging him on the back, and the shirtless guys playing sports. That I do wish, though, that they would have just cast Kelly McGillis and just been like, hey, I'm in my 50s. What's up? You know? So anyways, this looks like a sequel to Top Gun. That's about all I can say. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Just Mercy and 1917. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. I'm going to review two movies now that I don't think are going into wide release until January 10th, I believe. The reason I'm covering them now is because they are part of the award season. Both of these, I think more 1917 than Just Mercy, but 1917 is getting some serious award traction. And so, you know, it might win Golden Globes before it's even released. But these are in New York and LA, and they're movies that are getting that limited release now, right before the end of the year. I'll revisit them in a couple weeks. But the first one I want to hit is Just Mercy. A lawyer in Alabama takes on the cases of people that are possibly wrongfully convicted and put on death row.
The first time I visited death row, I wasn't expecting to meet somebody the same age as me. From a neighborhood just like ours. Could have been me, Mama.
But what you're doing is gonna make a lot of people upset.
You always taught me to fight for the people who need the help the most. Your life is still meaningful, and I'm gonna do everything possible to keep them from taking it.
You only know what you're into down here in Alabama when you're guilty from the moment you're born.
God,
Mr. McMillan.
We done here.
It's funny, all these movies nowadays, and I saw this when Spotlight came out several years ago, you can basically describe who's in the movie by what character they played in a superhero film. You've got the bad guy from Black Panther teaming up with Captain Marvel to try to free Electromo or whatever his name was from the Amazing Spider-Man movie because it stars Jamie Foxx. Michael B. Jordan, he's a good actor, but I think he's better as a villain. He's got an edge to himself, and it works when he plays the Creed character because he's kind of a hothead. But I really felt that he was better as a bad guy in Black Panther than he was as a hero in, you know, something like this. I think he's got a better career. He could play some great villain. Brie Larson she's kind of sidelined in this movie. Not as much as Rose Tycho is in the new Star Wars movie. But Brie Larson, she didn't have much of a role in this. She's just kind of supporting. It's mainly about this guy visiting these people on death row. The anchor case is the one that's played by Jamie Foxx. And his background is, I believe he's convicted for murder, but it was a sham trial. It was, I think, like the 60s in Alabama. They weren't terribly well known for always having the rights of African Americans in order. And it's one of these anti-death penalty movies. And they're very difficult to do. Because of two major things. The first thing with an anti-death penalty movie is it's very, very hard to present the people surrounding it. You always got this big family that's trying to save one of their loved ones from the death row. But you present them as these just like very meek and friendly and nice people. But it's a family, and it's anybody's family. We just had our holidays. Go back and think of anybody trying to take a snapshot of your family at Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner, and everyone's fighting. There's people who are good and bad, and there's people that are in smarmy, sleazy business, and people that are upright and standing. That's the way families are. And so when you see these movies, they kind of put everybody in the background as just the court audience. But you don't get the nuance of their family, and they kind of feel almost like strawmen back there. But that doesn't mean that their family deserves to be treated like less of a human being. That's a big point that can be made, but they kind of make them into these not realistic. They're these cardboard cutouts of the family, of just a grieving, hand-wringing family. The other problem they run into with a death penalty movie, and this one runs into it big time, is there's two arguments that are being made here. One of them is the death penalty's wrong and nobody should have to face it, regardless of if you did the crime. Or the person is wrongfully convicted and is facing the death penalty and shouldn't even be in there. Those are two very different arguments to make. Now, they're both valid arguments you can make against the death penalty, but the problem is they run into each other, because the whole part of the wrongful conviction is you're saying, well, we need to have greater oversight of the death penalty because look at all these people who really didn't commit the crime. And then you say, well, what about the people who absolutely did commit the crime? Well, they shouldn't either because the death penalty is wrong. I'm like, well, then isn't the death penalty being wrong your basis? But that's a harder argument to make than people being wrongfully convicted. And this movie tries to do both at different times and really stumbles around with it. I mean, overall, it's a fine movie and it tells a true story. And there is a lot to learn from this. And there is a lot you can take away and reconsider and reformulate your opinion on this matter. But it falls so much into cliches and it's very hard not to in a movie like this. So I'm going to have to say that ultimately, Just Mercy kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about 1917. I might revisit this later on when it opens wide, but just really quickly, Sam Mendes directs this World War I epic about a team of soldiers who have to travel to the front line to stop an invasion.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you fail, it will be a massacre.
We've got orders to cross here.
That is the German front line.
Hold back!
If we're not clever about this, no one will get to your brother.
I'm going to do just a real quick flyby on this one because I think there's a lot more to unpack, but I think it's something that's worth talking about when it comes out in wide release. But the catch to this movie, I don't want to say gimmick because it sounds like I'm being overly critical. It's not a gimmick, but the catch to this movie is it's meant to be a single shot. Now it's not. There's places, and if you have a trained eye and you see enough movies, you can be like, oh, that's probably where they did a cut or they don't. And there's one point in the movie where it does cut and it goes black for a reason. And that's obvious where he could have a cut. But otherwise, it's a one-shot movie. You know, like the movie Rope. Alfred Hitchcock did the movie Rope where he hid the cuts. I think there's like 8 reels of film in here and he plays it out so it looks like it's all taking place in real time in one cut. And we've had other movies. Silent House, I think that was one with Elizabeth Olsen, came out 5 or 6 years ago. That was another one that was a single-shot movie. This is kind of a feat because it is this recreation of World War I. It starts out in the trenches, literally, and you're moving through the trenches. And if you saw that documentary earlier this year, We Shall Not Grow Old, it really shows how authentic looking this is because that documentary showed the real trenches and this shows the people in the British trenches and it looks identical. It's very well done, very well shot. And then they got to move through here and then they got to go over the countryside and they're trying to stop an invasion from happening because they're going to get ambushed and they don't realize the enemy's completely dug in. And they've got to go through no man's land. They got to get all the way over to the other front lines and face other things and move through a city that's occupied. Beautiful cinematography, very well orchestrated. It does have some pacing issues, but I think that's just because of the nature of the beast, of the kind of movie it is. But it's a really neat film. It's one of them I'm pushing as best cinematography for my awards votes. But it's a neat film. And it's worth checking out. Well, I'll revisit it again in a couple weeks when it comes out on January 10th. But just suffice to say now, I'm going to say that 1917 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Spies in Disguise and Little Women. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with films that came out this week. They actually all came out on Wednesday, which was Christmas. Well, probably Christmas Eve. The first one is Spies in Disguise. Will Smith lends his voice to this animated spy tale about a super spy who becomes a pigeon in order to stop a high-value arms sale.
Agent Sterling! Wait! I've been working on this thing at home. It is going to change spying forever. It's called biodynamic concealment.
That next generation concealment tech, you wouldn't happen to have it on hand, would you?
You just drank it.
Ah! Oh!
Subject appears disoriented.
Foster, what did you do?
Pigeons are everywhere and nobody notices them.
Wow, girl.
It's the most perfect form a spy could take.
Okay, I have to admit, when I first saw the trailer for this, I think it was back this summer sometime, I thought this looked like the dumbest movie ever. I was saying to myself, this is going to be one of those movies, these animated films like Playmobil the movie, that's going to be just squeaked in under the radar. And I saw it had a Christmas Day release, and Christmas Day releases are really tricky because there are some movies that release on Christmas Day and get a following and they do extremely well. And some of them happen and they completely happen under the radar. Daddy's Home's a great example of that. Back in, I think, 2015, Daddy's Home came out the week after Star Wars The Force Awakens. And nobody remembers Daddy's Home as a hit because it didn't reach number one and had no chance of reaching number one because it was going up against Star Wars. But it did quite well. And it made a decent amount of money. And it just sort of stayed in there under what Star Wars was performing, and it was enough to do a sequel. So it was this movie that was a big hit that nobody remembers being a big hit. I mean, it wasn't like The Greatest Showman. That was another one that opened up, didn't hit number one or anything, but it just had staying power and continued on. So you get those movies that do well, and you almost don't realize they do well. Then you have this little thing where you release movies, and it's just so crowded that nobody takes notice. And maybe if you dropped the movie in October or August, people would have seen it. The remake of Point Break, which also came out in 2015, was a terrible movie, but it just disappeared under Star Wars and all the other movies. At Christmas, you have not just the Christmas Day releases, but you have all these other releases that come plowing into it. And so a movie like that Point Break remake, it just got lost in the shuffle, and I think it would have made at least a little more money if they released it in August. And that's what I was thinking with Spies in Disguise. I'm like, this movie looks like something they're hiding. This looks like something they're trying to throw in under the radar instead of trying to, you know, release it in September or August or even late July where, you know, you get a greater chance of kids coming to see it. Now, the one thing that's good about it from a perspective of releasing it in this marketplace, there really is no other animated movie out there aside from Frozen 2. And these don't draw from the same crowds. Frozen 2's the girl power Disney princess movie. Spies in Disguise is a action film for kids. So I think that they calculated that. I don't know how well it's going to play out. But what's interesting is the trailers make it look like it's a rinky-dink movie. It's not. It's a bona fide release. It's got action and effects, and it's more than just Will Smith collecting a paycheck. I had a chance to see this actually very, very early for consideration as a animated film for Best of the Year. So this one I had a lot of fun watching. We watched it over Thanksgiving, and it was an exciting action film. It's a spy movie. And I remember, you know, seeing movies like Cars 2, which I know a lot of people don't like, but I thought Cars 2 really worked because it was essentially a spy movie only with cars, and you could do some pretty grand stuff. And this one had Will Smith, who was, you know, he was playing the cool guy, but he got a chance to not be cool because he's a pigeon. You have Tom Holland playing the scientist, and he's if you don't know who Tom Holland is, he's Spider-Man in the new Marvel movies. And he plays the voice of the guy who's creating the pigeon formula. And it's a lot of fun. I had a blast. It has some great animation, has some great action. It's got some great humor. In this movie, I feel I'm afraid it's just going to disappear. Whereas I had an enjoyable time watching this. I mean, it's one of the better animated films, I think, of this year, just in the level of fun it delivers. So I'm going to have to say Spies in Disguise, surprisingly, totally rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Little Women. Greta Gerwig brings Louisa May Alcott's classic book to life again with modern sensibilities and a powerhouse cast.
I want to be an artist in Rome and be the best painter in the world.
That's what you want too, isn't it, Joe, to be a famous writer?
Yes, but it sounds so crass when she says it.
My girls have a way of getting into mischief.
Well, so do I.
This is Meg, Amy, Beth, and Joe.
I intend to make my own way in the world.
No one makes their own way, least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
You are not married, aren't you?
Well, that's because I'm rich.
First of all, this movie's not made for me. It's not called Big Fat Guys. It's called Little Women. And I think I have, as a kid, I had a copy of Louisa May Alcott's book Little Men, which is kind of the sequel to this. I never read Little Women. I've never seen an adaptation of it. And that's important to note. I'll get to that in a second. The story is about these four sisters growing up in, and they're relatively privileged. They're not wealthy, but they're well-to-do in the north, somewhere in the northeast. And they're not super wealthy, but they're not poor either. They're not dirt poor living in a shack. They don't want for anything. And their father's off fighting the Civil War. So it takes place during the Civil War, but it's not like a Civil War movie because it's not taking place in the South. The fighting's not happening in their backyard. It's just that sort of a background noise to the movie itself or the story. Having not read the book or having not seen any of the previous adaptations, of which there are many, I did find myself a little lost in it. Part of the thing is I think Greta Gerwig is a great director. I think she's proved that she knows how to shoot and assemble a movie. And I thought Lady Bird was a lot of fun and had a lot of truth and sweetness to it. This one does as well. But the problem that I had with the movie is she jumps around in the script. It's done in this non-linear timeline approach, which is cool. And that's always an option. The problem is I have trouble figuring out what happened when and what chronology things are going on in. Now, I watched it with more chunk of it with my wife because she had to go to bed. But when I saw she was following it, she's like, oh no, this takes place there. And that's 7 years before that and this and that. And I'm like, how do you follow that? And I realized she's either read the book or seen a movie of it. Even if she doesn't remember, it clicks in her head. But like, for example, Saoirse Ronan plays Joe and she's great in the movie. And at one point she cuts her hair and then at one point when she's wearing her hair up, that means she's older. But like, Emma Watson, who plays Meg, she looks the same in every scene. Timothy Chalamet plays the boy next door. He looks the same whether he's supposed to be in his 20s or his early teens. And Florence Pugh steals the show as Amy. I mean, she's hilarious and heartbreaking at times. And I think she really is the one, the breakout performer in this. But even then, there's scenes where she's, I'm assuming, is like 12 or 13. And by just the way she acts, and then there's other scenes where she's in her 20s. But she looks exactly the same. I mean, they did nothing to age them. And I found that difficult to follow. And that really impacted my ability to watch the movie. Otherwise, it's got great cast, looks beautiful. It does, as I understand it, tinker a little bit with the feminism. It makes it a little more relatable to modern audiences, which is fine. I mean, that's a legitimate choice for Gerwig to make. So although I think I respect the movie, it's not the greatest thing ever. And Laura Dern does not deserve all the praise she got for this, nor for Marriage Story. Laura Dern's kind of phoned in her pretentious performance the last couple movies. But Meryl Streep is a better performance in a supporting role in this movie. But the real standout's Florence Pugh. So ultimately, Little Women, like I said, it's not my cup of tea, but I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring the Universal Horror Collection, Volume 3.
Stop it now.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office and talk about the success that Star Wars was. Now, what's interesting is when it comes to box office, it's not just about how much money you make. It's also about how much people are anticipating you make. I've seen movies that make a ton of money at the box office, but they're anticipated to make more. And so they're sort of labeled a disappointment. And that almost happened with Star Wars because people didn't know how much it was going to be making going into the weekend. Now, what's funny about it is going into the weekend, it's the lowest of the three Star Wars movies. You had more than $250 million for The Force Awakens. You had like $220 million for The Last Jedi. And this one only made $178 million. Now, what was interesting is all the tracking beforehand, Disney was saying, well, we're thinking maybe $150, $160 million for the opening weekend. And other sources were saying, you know, $170, $180, maybe $190 million. Could it make over $200 million? And Disney was really backing away from that $200 million threshold, partly because I think their numbers played out that they didn't have that. And I think part of that is less about The Rise of Skywalker and more about people being a little bit skittish from The Last Jedi. Because while The Last Jedi had a big opening, the following Star Wars movie was Solo, and I think that that did severe damage. I think that took the wind out of the sails of any Star Wars movie after The Last Jedi, and a lot of people were reluctant to go. And so I think you're seeing this as well. So I think it's going to be less front-loaded than you would expect for a sequel like this. And that's actually playing out in the box office. Because it made that over almost $180 million opening weekend, and then as you're watching it track, the money it made on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day was a huge uptick. Now, you always get a bump at Christmas because it's a big day to go see movies, but you don't get that massive uptick that you would expect for Memorial Day or 4th of July as much. But what Star Wars made on Christmas Day was $32 million, which was an increase of almost daily from 60% from Christmas Eve. And even Christmas Eve was $20 million. That's actually a lot to make on Christmas Eve because everybody's doing last-minute preparation. And then it made $32 million on Christmas Day, which is the second highest Christmas Day ever, second to The Force Awakens. So it's playing out better, and it's timing out with the Christmas week because now it's just got all of this week and this weekend and then all of next week as well, because all you got next week is The Grudge. So it's going to run, it's getting like three solid weeks of people going while they have time off of work and while they have time off of school and with very little competition, because the only thing that came out the same day was Cats, and that thing flopped. That made $6.5 million, which is terrible for a big release like that. But there was nothing else running against it. And it's, I really don't think Little Women's going to draw much from Star Wars. I certainly don't think it's going to get knocked down from Spies in Disguise or Uncut Gems. Those are, I mean, Spies in Disguise is going for the same audience, but I don't think that's going to perform nearly enough to really dig into the amount that Star Wars is going to make. And internationally, by the time I finish this sentence, it's like it's $600 million internationally, which is just half of what The Last Jedi made. So I really think you're going to see this have better legs than The Last Jedi. And The Last Jedi had decent legs, but I think this is going to have better legs because also the audiences seem to like it more. Forget that B+ cinema score. I think that's a lot of the Last Jedi fans upset pushing that score down. I think your average audience, your actual real average audience, is much higher, because everybody I've talked to, the average folks have loved Star Wars. So mark my word, I really think Star Wars is going to be a huge box office success this year, more than I think a lot of people are anticipating. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This actually came out last week, but I wanted to cover it this week because I don't have anything happening this week. Nobody releases movies in terms of DVDs and Blu-rays at Christmas or New Year's because the buying window's a couple weeks before that. But this one came out last week, and it is the Universal Horror Collection, Volume 3. Not from Universal, it's from Shout Factory or Scream Factory, mind you. They've done two other box sets. One of them had most of the movies had Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, and then the next set, the sort of like the common thread in those was Lionel Atwell. And these are some smaller, less well-remembered horror films. There's some of them are an hour long. Some of them are 70 minutes long. And they're a lot of fun because they go back to the 30s and the 40s. There's two I want to spotlight. One is Man-Made Monster. With dangerous experimentation and electricity, a corrupted scientist creates a monster with supernatural powers.
Now you'll do exactly as I say. Step down.
I'd always found the female of the species was more responsive to electrical impulse than was the male. It's fortunate that we met here.
Shall I show you how it was done?
This one stars Lon Chaney Jr., who's best known for being the Wolfman. What's funny is it's also directed by the same guy who directed the Wolfman, which was George Wagner. And he plays a very similar character to Lyle Talbot when he first shows up, this sort of this easygoing kind of flirtatious guy before he turns into a monster. Now, this is a mad scientist movie. It's got Lionel Atwell as the bad guy or as the mad scientist. So he's fun to watch in this. It's a lesser movie, but it also calls back to some other Lon Chaney movies like The Indestructible Man, which you may have seen on Mystery Science Theater. But this is a nice little disposable horror movie from the 40s. And it's real short. It's like 60 minutes. And the other one that I wanted to highlight is Horror Island. After stumbling upon a treasure map, a ship's captain brings a group of adventurers to an island looking for a treasure but finding horrors.
Leave the castle. Leave the castle.
That's the voice. That's it.
You see, you need a real dead body or it won't work.
It's George. He's been murdered.
This is another one that's really short. It's 61 minutes, also directed by George Wagner, which seems to be generally the common thread in this one. What's fun about Horror Island is it's this mix of horror movie and sort of jungle adventure. It has this phantom that they're chasing, and they bring these people to this island. This, along with another one of the movies in here, which is The Black Cat, feels like one of those sort of like the screwball, in a little ways, a screwball comedy of them trying to find somebody in a haunted house. Although in this one, it's an island. They do that with The Black Cat, which is more of a haunted house type thing. This one's a little more fun. The George Wagner stuff tends to be a little more whimsical and has a little bit more of of some humor elements to it. And those are cute little movies. No one really huge in Horror Island. Now, there's two other movies in the mix. One of them is The Tower of London. And the reason I think this one made it into the collection is because of the stars. Basil Rathbone plays Richard III, and you've got Boris Karloff playing his muscle, his heavy, who's an executioner. You also have Vincent Price in the role as a duke. And it's less of a horror movie because it's more of a historical movie. It's about Richard III coming to power and putting his nephews in prison in the Tower of London. You think Tower of London because it's going to be all this torture. There isn't. It's kind of low key. So that one actually was least my favorite of the group because it was less of a horror movie. And then there's The Black Cat, which is not the same Black Cat that had Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi that was in the first volume of this. This is a remake, which is following more of the story of the Cat and the Canary about a bunch of people. Again, a sort of this screwball group of people in a house that's haunted trying to find out who the killer is. This one also has some names in it. Basil Rathbone's in it. It has Anne Gwynn, who shows up in one of the Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman movies. And then, of course, you got Bela Lugosi as the caretaker, but it's not one of Lugosi's better roles. But all of these come in this box set. You got four Blu-rays. All of them come with an audio commentary with a new film historian. And also they have these still galleries and their trailers involved in them as well. And the Tower of London's got a new 2K scan of the print. But these are fun little collections. If you want to go see the lesser known horror films from Universal that Universal isn't clutching onto in its old age. So I'm going to have to say the Universal Horror Collection Volume 3 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also out this week on DVD and Blu-ray are Judy and The Gallows Act 2. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next year, I'm going to be talking about The Grudge. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.